Happens in Idaho is a podcast following the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. This podcast is hosted and produced by me, Kayla Waters, in correlation with my other podcast, True Crime Exposed. I have followed this case closely as it all came to an end here in Idaho, just 30 minutes north of where I grew up and currently live. I will be attending most days of Lori Daybell's trial at the Madison County Courthouse in Rexburg, Idaho. This is the area which the crimes took place, and this is the only location outside of Ada County that has access to the live stream of this trial. Each day, I will recap the trial for you here. Welcome to It Ends in Idaho, the Lori Daybell Trial. We're starting off today's episode with the testimony of April Raymond. Rachel Smith will conduct the direct examination for the prosecution. April testifies that since the trial has started, she did receive a Facebook message of reporter Justin Lum doing an interview with one of Lori's cousins. This interview had nothing to do with the trial, and April did not witness anything that had to do with trial testimony. Remember, there is an exclusionary rule in this trial, meaning that all witnesses are not allowed to view or read about witness testimony that has come before them. Jim Archibald really wants to ask April about her contact with the media, giving media interviews, and if she's agreed to do media interviews following this trial. Ms. Smith continues to object Jim's questions, most of which are sustained by Judge Boyce. But Jim is allowed to ask if any of the media members have told April what has been going on during this trial, and she says no. She replied to all media inquiries since the trial has started with the directive from her subpoena, letting them know that she was unable to participate in anything at the moment. Once it's determined that April has not broken the exclusionary rule, she testifies that she met Lori while Lori was living on the Hawaiian island Kauai. That is where April still lives to this day, and she says that they met at church. Lori was the president of the primary, which is scary in hindsight because primary is the class young children attend, usually between ages 4 to 12. She asked April to be her counselor in this calling. They became fast friends that spent a lot of time together with each other's children and in each other's homes. April says they saw each other at least once a week. At this time, Lori was married to Charles Vallow. Tylee and JJ lived there with them full time. Colby was there on and off. Following the Vallows' move away from Hawaii and back to Arizona, April and Lori still kept in touch. Lori would visit April in February of 2019, the weekend before Valentine's Day. Ms. Smith asked if this was a planned visit, and April says no, it was a very unexpected one. Once April and Lori were able to meet, April says Lori told her a lot had changed. She was leaving Charles because he had an affair. And then April says the conversation steered in a different direction. Lori starts telling her how Charles was not Charles, and instead, he was a demon named Ned Schneider. During this visit, Tylee was with Lori, and Charles had JJ in Houston, Texas. April said Lori stated she was done with JJ, so Charles and his sister Kay would have to figure it out. Ms. Smith asks what she thought Lori meant by done with JJ. April says she thought Lori meant in the divorce. She would take the main care of Tylee and Charles would take main care of JJ. Now Rachel Smith wants to know what Lori meant by Charles is no longer Charles. April says that she meant Charles was already dead and had a demon living inside him, using his body as a host. Lori said she knew this was not Charles because he was now shorter. Following the week Lori stayed in April's house, she then checked into the Kauai Beach Resort. April testifies that it was her understanding Tylee had returned to Arizona for work at her aunt's chiropractic clinic. Melanie Gibb joined Lori at the Kauai Beach Resort, and April recalls going to hang out with them a couple times for lunches or dinners. During one of these dinners, April says that Lori showed her an email Charles had sent to Lori's family, pleading for help. Melanie Gibb confirmed what Lori was saying, that Charles had a demon living inside of him. Lori told April about the time where she believed she found evidence of Charles having an affair, so she canceled his credit cards, picked up his car, and left him stranded. Now Ms. Smith asks if there were any conversations surrounding April being a part of the 144,000 that Lori was meant to gather. April testifies that this conversation took place one night when Lori and Tylee were staying with her. After telling April that Lori was there to gather her for this mission, Lori noted that in order to join the 144,000, April would need to be separated from her children. April testified that Lori claimed she had fulfilled her duties to them as their mother, and she had a greater purpose now. Rachel Smith has no further questions. Jim Archibald stands to conduct cross-examination for the defense. He starts by noting that Lori lived in Hawaii for 1 to 2 years around 2016 and 2017. He asks, while April was reconnecting with her old friend Lori in 2019, did she notice a change in her belief system? And April testifies yes. She goes on to testify that it was her understanding Lori had changed her belief system because she was a part of this new group. Jim has April confirm that back in 2016 and 2017, she hadn't noticed any peculiar beliefs outside of the norm from Lori. April agrees. However, she adds that during a visit from Lori in July of 2018, Lori mentioned some of these beliefs. They were more amplified in 2019. April testifies that she told Lori she did not share these same beliefs. Jim wants to know what Lori's reaction was, and April testifies that she wasn't upset. It seemed like Lori just thought April was not ready to hear it. Jim asks if April had ever met Melanie Gibb before that trip to Hawaii, and April replies no. Then he asks if it seems that Melanie Gibb shared the same belief system as Lori, and April testifies yes. She says she felt like her interaction with Lori and Melanie felt like a subtle grooming. She said she was not interested. And Jim Archibald has no further questions. Ms. Smith stands for redirect and wants to ask what group Melanie was referring to in the cross-examination. And Melanie says that Lori told her she was the leader of gathering the 144,000. And the group that April was referring to was a podcast group. Lori had become a part of this group where she would podcast with friends. Rachel Smith asks who was in this group. And April testifies from what she remembers, Lori referred to Zulema Pastines, Melanie Gibb, Jason Mao, a man named Thor, and Chad Daybell. Rachel asks if the individuals in this podcast group were committed to this mission of gathering the 144,000. April testifies that this was her understanding. With that, Rachel Smith has no further questions, and day 7 of witness testimony, day 12 of the entire trial starting from jury selection, comes to a conclusion. On day 8 of witness testimony, the prosecution starts by calling Sergeant Nathan Moffitt of the Chandler Police Department in Arizona. Lindsay Blake will conduct this direct examination. Sergeant Moffitt was the case agent for the investigation into the death of Charles Vallow. Upon arrival, while walking through the scene, the detective did not see Lori Vallow present. He did see Alex Cox and observed Charles. Back at the station, Sergeant Moffitt interviewed Alex Cox. He indicates that Alex said the argument between Charles and Lori never got physical. Charles was just following Lori around the house while she kept his phone from him. Alex claimed that Charles hit him in the back of the head with a baseball bat. Miss Blake asks if the sergeant witnessed any injuries on Alex. He testifies that there was a small laceration on the back of Alex's head, but not what he would expect for someone being hit in the back of the head with a baseball bat by a very athletic man. Alex says he went into his room to retrieve his gun, and he came out telling Charles to drop the bat. Alex claimed that Charles said, "What are you gonna do about it?" Alex then tells the detective that he's not sure how many times he shot Charles, but it was more than once in center mass. Sergeant Moffitt testified that Charles was shot in center mass. Alex said he didn't know where Lori and Tylee were at the time of the shooting. He also indicated that he performed CPR after being asked to by the dispatcher. Alex said that he spent the night because he was trying to help Lori, who asked him to be there for safety. Based on what Sergeant Moffitt learned from Detective Inclan, he asked Alex if he had called anyone else before calling 911. Alex said no. But remember, Lori told Detective Inclan that Alex called her first, and she told him to call 911. While at the scene, Charles' body was rolled over, and Sergeant Moffitt observed that there was one bullet strike on a baseboard and one beneath where Charles' body had laid. This indicated that Charles was shot a second time while laying on his back following the first shot. Lindsay Blake asks if this was consistent with how Alex Cox described the incidents, and the detective answers no. Now the prosecution wants to know what Sergeant Moffitt observed on the drive back to Lori's home following the interviews at the police station. He testifies that they took a minivan. Tylee sat in the front passenger seat while Detective Inclan was driving. Lori and Alex were sitting in the middle seats, and Sergeant Moffitt sat in the back row. He describes the ride back as bizarre, to say the least. The conversations were lighthearted. In June of 2020, Nathan Moffitt was promoted to sergeant. At this time, he was removed from being the case agent as it needed to stay back with the homicide unit. So, Detective Duncan took over as case agent. We heard from him earlier this same week. Sergeant Nathan Moffitt testified that he did find Charles Vallow had a $1 million life insurance policy. Upon speaking with the insurance company, he learned there was confusion due to a recent change of beneficiary. A couple months prior to this event, Charles had changed the beneficiary from his wife Lori to his sister Kay. When the sergeant is inquiring, the legal department of the insurance company was reviewing the paperwork. After Nathan Moffitt says that the insurance policy was paid out, but not to Lori Vallow, Lindsay Blake says she has no further questions. Jim Archibald notes that he has previously objected to this witness's testimony as a whole. He's done this with all officials out of Arizona based on the fact that Lori is not being charged with anything from Arizona and has never been charged. On that note, he states that because of these objections he's had, he has no questions. Sergeant Nathan Moffitt is officially released as a witness, and he leaves the witness stand. Next up, the state calls 26-year-old Sydney Schenck. Sydney currently lives in Arizona. However, she came in contact with Lori Vallow while living in Rexburg, Idaho, during the year 2019. Sydney was a student at BYU Idaho, and she was looking for work. She placed a listing to be a nanny on care.com. Sydney and Lori messaged each other before setting up an interview to see if Sydney would be a good fit as a nanny for JJ Vallow. Sydney met with Lori on Wednesday, September 18, 2019 at Lori's townhome in Rexburg. Rob Wood is conducting this direct examination for the prosecution, and he asks how the interaction with Lori went. Sydney said it went well. Lori greeted her with a hug. She met JJ and learned about their life and their recent move from Arizona to Rexburg. Lori told Sydney that JJ had special tendencies. She explained that he was diagnosed with autism. Lori said that JJ got emotional and frustrated easily. She also said he would get distracted, but if you look him directly in the eyes when giving a command, he would listen better. Lori told Sydney that JJ's father had recently died of a heart attack and that JJ was having a hard time understanding. Rob Wood asks if she saw a teenage girl while visiting Lori's home. Sydney says she did not, but that Lori did mention she had a daughter also living in Rexburg and attending the college. Lori said while her daughter would come visit and do laundry, she did not like to babysit without being paid, and that's why Lori is now searching for a nanny. At the conclusion of this meeting, Lori hires Sydney to return the next day as JJ's nanny. That following day, Sydney went to Lori's home for a few hours after finishing up classes for the day. Lori had to go to the airport to pick up a friend. Lori gave Sydney some ideas of what she could do with JJ. She suggested taking him to Gravity Factory. This is a trampoline park in Rexburg, Idaho. Lori mentions that if she arrives home later than planned, then Sydney can give JJ his medication that would help him fall asleep. Sydney recalls that the day went well. JJ played outside with the neighbors before she brought him in for dinner. After eating, JJ went back over to his friend's townhome. Sydney testified that when she went to pick JJ up, she learned that him and his friend were in a dispute over not sharing toys. With that, Sydney brings JJ home and says that JJ was upset. He's sad that his friend no longer wanted to play. Back at the townhome, JJ became angry. He threw an ottoman as well as a chair. Sydney did what she could to calm him down, but ultimately he ran upstairs wanting to be alone and hide. She testifies that she hoped he would calm down, but he didn't. By the time Lori came home, JJ was still upset. Sydney explained what happened with JJ and his friend, and she said that Lori calmed him down. Both Lori's brother and friend were also there by this time. Lori paid Sydney in cash and she left. I'll note here that the friend is Melanie Gibb. Remember, Melanie traveled to Idaho just before JJ is believed to have been killed. Sydney testifies that they didn't talk about the next time she would watch JJ because of the situation going on, but she was under the impression that she would watch JJ again shortly. She was made to believe that JJ would need assistance almost daily. After a few days had passed, Sydney texts Lori asking when she would be watching him again. Lori informed Sydney that JJ had gone to his grandparents for a month and that she would be in Hawaii for that month. Lori told her that once the family returns to Rexburg, Sydney could reach back out about watching JJ. Rob Wood asks if Sydney did contact Lori again, and she testifies yes. After the month had passed, Sydney messaged Lori, but never received a response. Rob Wood asks if she ever saw JJ Vallow after September 19th, 2019. Sydney replies, "No, I did not." And with that, Rob Wood concludes his questioning. Jim Archibald will be asking questions for cross-examination. He asks Sydney if JJ was present during the initial meeting on September 18th. She says yes, and Mr. Archibald wants to know if there was a specific schedule set for her to nanny or if she would just be called when needed. Sydney says she was just going to be called when Lori needed her, and because she was a student, her time outside of classes was flexible. Jim asks if Sydney was given information about JJ because she was being expected to watch JJ over the long term, like over the next year. Sydney says there was no mention of a year specifically, but she was expecting at least working for Lori the next several months. Jim says, "Lori made no indication that she was going to hire you for this week and never again?" Sydney testifies, "Yes." And with that, Jim Archibald concludes his cross-examination. Sydney Schenck is released from her subpoena. Now, Prosecutor Spencer Rammel will be questioning Dr. David Joshua Wilson. He goes by Josh. Dr. Wilson is the principal of Kennedy Elementary School in Rexburg, Idaho. He's been in this position for 4 years, including the year of 2019. Joshua Jackson Vallow was a student enrolled in this elementary school. This is JJ. Josh testifies that JJ was enrolled at Kennedy Elementary School from September 3, 2019 through September 24, 2019. Mr. Rammel asks if Dr. Wilson recalls the last day JJ was physically present at the school. He testifies that if he remembers correctly, it was Friday, September 20th, 2019. JJ was not present on Monday, September 23rd, 2019. He was unenrolled on Tuesday, September 24th, 2019. Lori Vallow emailed the school indicating that they were removing JJ from school and sending him to Louisiana to live with his grandparents. Josh Wilson called Lori in response to this email. He told her that once JJ was enrolled at a school in Louisiana, she can have the school contact their school and they would forward any records they had on file. At that point, Lori tells Dr. Wilson that they would be homeschooling JJ. She says there was a cousin with similar needs to JJ, so the grandparents were going to homeschool them together. Spencer Rammel has no further questions, and Jim Archibald conducts the cross-examination, asking Josh if he was present when JJ was enrolled. He testifies that he was. He also notes that the elementary school did have a special needs program. Jim wants the principal to confirm that during JJ's registration, Lori stated she planned to enroll JJ for long term. Dr. Wilson does say he was under the impression that JJ would be attending for the remainder of the school year, and it was a surprise when JJ was unenrolled shortly after being enrolled. The defense has no further questions. Spencer Rammel will also conduct direct examination of the next witness, Wynn Hill. He has been an employee of Brigham Young University in Idaho for the last 17 years, and he is the Dean of Students for BYUI. Wynn testifies that he was asked by the Rexburg Police Department to search the student management system for Tylee Ryan, Tylee Cox, or Tylee Vallow with the birth date of September 24, 2002. There was no indication of a student by any of these names. There was not even an application ever started. The prosecution has no further questions, and the defense has no questions. With that, Wynn Hill is released from the subpoena and led off the stand by the bailiff. Since witnesses have gone through so quickly on this morning, the next witness is not quite at the courthouse. With that, and a matter that needs to be taken up outside the presence of the jury, Judge Boyce calls for an earlier than normal mid-morning break. The issue is that the next witness may have violated the exclusionary rule. Judge Boyce says they will question the witness before making a determination on if this witness can testify in front of the jury. At this time, the jurors are still out on break. Following this mid-morning break, the state now calls David Warwick to the stand. Rachel Smith will be conducting direct examination. David testifies that he has been married to Melanie Gibb since December 12, 2021. David says that when his wife Melanie testified in the weeks before him, he had been sick and was unable to attend. He even says that Melanie was quite upset with him that he did not come because she did not want to go alone. So he had listened to 45 minutes of her testimony before realizing that this would break the exclusionary rule in this case. When he realized, he shut it off. David notes that he was not in the right frame of mind due to being sick. He mentions something about basically breathing underwater, and then he says he just got on antibiotics 2 days before this so that he could come and testify because he was not getting better. He says what he heard would not affect his testimony today. David says that they have not talked about the case. He says that Melanie lives in Arizona and he lives in Utah. He says they have a distant relationship right now due to family needs. Quote, "I guess she needed some time, so I just left her alone." Jim Archibald is allowed to question David for the defense in regards to the issue of the exclusionary rule. Jim asks what David and Melanie talked about following his wife's testimony, but David says they haven't talked at all. Jim says, quote, "So you haven't talked to your wife since last week?" And David says no. Jim then wants to know where Melanie is right now, and David replies that Melanie is back home working in Arizona. He says he knows this because that's where she lives and he knows she works. David notes that Melanie took a week off to come here and testify, and she couldn't take any more time off. Jim asks how David would know Melanie was not in Boise any longer if he had never talked to her. David says, quote, "Well, I got a text from her saying she was done and going home, but we didn't talk about the case." Jim asks what David learned from listening to Melanie's testimony, and he says nothing. He said he wasn't listening for anything, and he was just listening to see how Melanie was. He was sick, so he really wasn't paying attention. Jim asks how Melanie's tone of voice was, and David replied, "She seemed somber." David testifies that he listened to the audio on YouTube, and it was either Hidden True Crime or East Idaho News that had posted the audio. Rachel Smith stands to clarify that anything David heard within Melanie Gibbs' testimony won't affect or change what he has testified to 2 or 3 other times prior, when he previously testified under oath at preliminary hearings and in front of a grand jury. He says no. Jim Archibald tells Judge Boyce that Idaho Rule of Evidence 615 has been violated. The defense asks that the witness be excluded. Rachel states that the court needs to consider the willful nature of the conduct and whether there is any harm done to the testimony of the witness. She cites State v. Danson 113, Idaho 746. In there, the court knows it has broad latitude under Idaho Rule 615. Rachel notes that this is his wife. David wanted to check on how she was doing. She says this is one of the hazards of a trial that is recorded and published across the country. That presents significant risks to the situation happening. What is notable, she says, is when this witness was asked by prosecution and officers, he immediately admitted to the wrongdoing. Rachel says again that David had previously testified under oath multiple times, and he has given multiple interviews recorded by police. Rachel says there are other remedies short of the extreme ruling to exclude the witness as a whole. She states that the judge can craft an instruction to the jury, allowing them to consider that he has listened to portions of his wife's testimony. She says the court can also allow the defense to take a statement from Mr. Warwick by taking a break and having them collect that before he testifies. Jim Archibald says that they have rules in place for a reason, not so that the witness can say, "Golly gee, I made a mistake." His reasons are irrelevant, says Jim. This rule protects the integrity of the court. Judge Boyce says that he has carefully considered the testimony of this witness. The judge issued an order before the trial started for exclusion of a witness in this case that broke the rule. He notes that the case Ms. Smith referenced does state it's in the trial court's discretion to determine the nature of any sanction. He says that case also cites the State v. Christensen case 100 Idaho 631. Judge Boyce says there are 4 options given for the situation. The first would be that David Warwick could be held in contempt of court. The second would be to permit comment on the witness non-compliance in order to reflect on his credibility. The third would be refusing to let the witness testify. And the fourth would be to strike the witness testimony, which would not apply here because he has not already testified. Judge Boyce says we do not make it to number 4 because the state and witness willingly disclose the information prior to the testimony. Judge Boyce does not feel that being held in contempt of court would be appropriate, so he is looking at the other 2 options, allowing comment or refusing to let the witness testify. David testified that what he heard would not affect his testimony. The rule is put in place to refrain from what witnesses hear affecting what they will testify about. Judge Boyce feels that this was a willful misconduct against the order. So the court is going to allow the defense an appropriate sanction to permit a comment on the witness noncompliance in order to reflect on the witness credibility. This will be liberally permitted to be asked about during cross-examination. Judge Boyce lets David know that it's unfortunate this happened and it has created a delay in the trial. However, he appreciates David bringing the issue up to prosecutors before he came on the stand. Now Rachel Smith is allowed to start her direct examination of David Warwick. He says that he first met Lori in Arizona when Lori called Melanie Gibb asking her to bring David over so that Lori could meet him. So Melanie and David make their way to Lori's home in Chandler, Arizona. It was the first week of August 2019, and David says Lori was widowed. Rachel asks who was at Lori's home. He testifies Chad, Alex, Melanie Boudreaux, Zulema, and another lady whose name he can't remember. Prior to August of 2019, David says he had talked with Chad Daybell over the phone. Chad had reached out to David years earlier because Chad wanted to do a book with him. David did not ever create this book with Chad. He testified that he felt it wasn't right. During the meeting at Lori's home in Chandler, Arizona, David says Lori was an amazing host. Melanie and Lori wanted to do a podcast episode with David in Arizona, but that never happened. Rachel Smith asks if David had another opportunity to meet Lori in person, and he says yes, in Rexburg, Idaho. He was traveling up for a few different reasons, to see Melanie Gibb, for a Book of Mormon conference, and because his son had recently moved to Pocatello, Idaho. Lori and Melanie wanted to record a podcast episode at Lori's apartment during this visit. The trip was in late September 2019. Remember, we heard testimony from his wife, Melanie Gibb, about this trip. They were not married back then, but they were dating. They are married now. Melanie and Lori were visiting during the time it's believed J.J. Vallow was murdered. David was the last person besides Lori, Chad, and Alex to see J.J. inside of Lori Vallow's townhome. David says that he was going to stay at a hotel in Idaho Falls so he could be in the middle of Rexburg and Pocatello, but Melanie told him Lori had an extra room. This was the first time David met J.J. Vallow. He testifies, quote, "I have a Down syndrome boy, autistic, so I just sat down with him to include him. I wanted to see how he was doing and talk to him, but it was like I wasn't even there. He never acknowledged me." Later that weekend, JJ had a cardboard box he was cutting windows into, making a little home-like fort. But David says that it was the same experience he described earlier. David also says that he witnessed JJ with Alex. They interacted, and it seemed like a good relationship. When JJ went outside to play, he seemed really happy. Rachel asks if Chad Daybell was present at all during this trip, and David testifies yes. Chad was trying to teach David about some of his beliefs, such as gathering the 144,000, and how Satan had powers to push people out of their bodies, and the spirit was stuck in this middle world. Melanie and Lori were present during these conversations. David says that the women didn't really participate in the conversation, and that Chad led the way. He says he told Chad that if the Lord was gathering 144,000, he feels it would not be done through him, but instead it would be done through the prophet. He also says that he told Chad he was taught differently about Satan, and that he doesn't believe he has the power to push the spirit out of someone. Miss Smith wants David to confirm that he is a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and that his beliefs were more in line with their mainstream teaching. He did not believe Chad. Later, David and Melanie met with Chad and Lori near a church. Chad and Lori were describing a heavenly temple that was nearby. They could see it, but David said he could not see anything, and he did not believe a building was there. He tried to be respectful and follow along, is what he says. Later, David goes to look at 80 acres for sale near Chad's property. David testifies that his interest was because he had an investor down in Utah that wanted to do a development in Idaho. He says Chad was interested in it because he wanted David to move to Rexburg. Alex had taken David to the property initially, and then Chad showed up with a realtor, a friend of his, who was serving with Chad Daybell in the LDS Church. David testifies that he told Chad he does not do business on Sunday, and he did not want to talk about it. Following this interaction, David testifies he never saw Chad Daybell again. Now Rachel Smith wants to go back to when David had seen Chad through the weekend at Lori's townhome. David testifies that Chad and Lori were very affectionate, and he was aware that Chad was still married to Tammy. So David testifies that he asked Chad if Tammy was a good wife. He says that Chad told him he had no complaints about Tammy, but that her time on this earth was limited and almost up. Chad had a dream that Tammy would pass away before he turned 50. So Chad and Lori were about to start their journey together with what they committed to do for God. The prosecution asks, "So did you have any response to this?" And David says that this is when he mentioned this 144,000 gathering should come through the prophet of the LDS Church if it's true. Chad claimed that this Church of the Firstborn he and Lori were creating was coming out of the LDS Church, and that Chad had his authority from John the Beloved. David testifies that these were not his beliefs. Now, remember how David was supposed to record a podcast episode in Arizona? Well, that never happened, but David did record a podcast episode with Lori and Melanie Gibb in Lori Vallow's kitchen at the island. I'll note here that if you know anything about podcasts, it's clear that Lori did not, and that sound quality was probably awful recording from the kitchen table. I have no room to act superior. I struggled with my audio in the early days too, but hey, I'll take a dig at Lori wherever I can find one. I'll dig at anyone who conspires to murder their own children. During the podcast recording, David testified that JJ was not in Lori's apartment. Lori had told David that Alex Cox was babysitting him in his own townhome at the same complex. Miss Smith asks if David saw JJ at all that evening. He says yes. Around 10:30 p.m., David heard the front door open. He turned to see Alex Cox walk inside holding JJ, who was asleep, resting his head on Alex's shoulder. David testifies that Alex took JJ upstairs to go to bed. The prosecution asks if David recalls what JJ was wearing. He says, quote, "It seems like it was shorts and a t-shirt, but I can't remember the colors. I almost want to say it was the camouflage shorts." Rachel moves on to ask David if he saw Alex leave that night. And David says he heard the door open again, but he didn't turn around to look. The front door was facing his back, and David says he stayed focused on the podcast. So it seems that David is saying Alex brought JJ back and put him to bed during this podcast recording. He said they were recording this podcast on the night of Sunday, September 22nd, 2019. During this trip, JJ was staying in Lori's room, and David was staying in JJ's room. After going to sleep Sunday night, David testifies that he woke up in the early morning hours. He says he had a nightmare, and it felt very real. Melanie came to try and help David during this nightmare. He says that Melanie heard him screaming out, so she came in and helped to wake him up. Once David was awake, he says that Melanie went to get Lori so that they could try and get Chad over to the house to give David a blessing. David didn't ever see Lori in the middle of the night, and Melanie could not get in contact with Lori. We heard Melanie Gibb talk about this incident when she testified earlier in this trial. David says the next morning, JJ was not home. He testifies that Lori told him JJ had this episode the night before. He climbed onto her counters and then onto her upper cabinets. She mentions that JJ knocked over her picture of Jesus, so she had Alex Cox come and take him. Rachel Smith asks, "So when she told you she had Alex take JJ, what did you do?" And David says, quote, "Well, before she told me Alex took JJ, I asked to see him because I wanted to make sure he was okay." Rachel quickly asks, "Why?" David testifies that he didn't see any signs of damage on the cabinets or scuffs on the fridge. So David claims he was trying to understand what was going on here, and if JJ was having a problem, David wanted to give him a blessing. The date of this interaction with Lori was Monday, September 23rd, 2019. The prosecution has no further questions. Jim Archibald will be conducting cross-examination for the defense. He asks David, "During the September 2019 trip, were David or Melanie still married to anyone else?" But David testifies no. Jim asks if him and Melanie were seeing each other before they were divorced. The prosecution objects, but Judge Boyce overrules the objection. David testifies that they were seeing each other at events. He says that Melanie was divorced, but his divorce had taken longer to finalize than he planned. Jim asks if Melanie and David were interested in each other because of their shared religious beliefs. He testifies yes, and agrees that this is also how he came in contact with Lori, Chad, Alex, Zulema, and others. David testifies that he was involved in a religious podcast. Jim asked who the audience was, like who were they selling it to? There's an objection for relevance, and Jim states that David told the prosecution he did podcasts with Lori and Melanie, as well as the Preparing a People group. David testifies that Preparing a People group was not sponsored by the LDS Church, and that he didn't make any money off podcasts. He says he maybe explained it wrong, saying he did interviews with Preparing the People when they would highlight different topics. David says that Preparing the People is not a group, but more of a conference where they invite speakers and others to present. He talked with them about his dreams and visions. Mr. Archibald asks if he would call himself a visionary man. David says others have called him that, but he doesn't call himself anything. Jim asks David if he has given talks of secret combinations in Washington, D.C., England, and Saudi Arabia. David answers yes. Then Mr. Archibald asks, "You've given talks about evil entities in England, right?" And David said, "No, I'm not sure where that one is going." Jim moves on to say, "You've seen visions of Russia and China invading the United States and attacking the United States military, defeating us in 3 days. And David says, "Yes." Jim asks if David has seen visions of the United States being sacrificed for a one-world government. David testifies, "I don't know where that one came from." And Jim Archibald replies, "Well, I didn't make this up." David says that the context here is missing, so it's difficult. The prosecution objects, citing relevance, and Judge Boyce says that he does believe we are now getting away from the evidence of the objection. When a previous objection came from the prosecution at the start of Jim asking David about his beliefs, Judge Boyce had overruled it. So now he wants Jim to tie it in somehow. Otherwise, he will sustain the objection. So the defense asks if it's right that David told the prosecutors that he had a vision in September of 2019. Rachel Smith objects, stating misstates the evidence. The judge overrules the objection and tells David that he can correct the defense if this statement is incorrect. David says he had a nightmare in September of 2019. And Jim Archibald asks David to explain the difference between a nightmare and a vision. David says whatever the nightmare was about, it felt like he was living in it. Mr. Archibald asks, so a vision is just pretend? But David says no. A vision is when you're observing something you're being shown. David testifies that his visions came from the angels of God. His nightmare is an adversarial. He says that there was a lot of darkness and fear. David does not know who the nightmare came from. The defense asks, when you say adversarial, do you mean the devil? And David testifies, I would say it came from that direction. He goes on to say that that night he was so distraught. So when Melanie said she was going to get Lori to see if Chad could give him a blessing, David agreed. He said he was not all there. He was struggling because he was horrified with what he was seeing. Mr. Archibald asks, were you in the same room as Melanie that night of the nightmare? Were you in JJ's room? And David says, yes. Then Jim asks, and you woke Melanie up after being awoken by your nightmare? David testifies, no, Melanie woke him up. Now the defense asks David if he saw a scratch on Chad Daybell's neck from JJ Vallow that weekend. David says that Chad pointed it out, but that it was pretty minor. He goes on to say that he did not see the scuffle, but Chad did tell him about it. Mr. Archibald asks who John the Beloved is, and David says that this is a close disciple of Jesus Christ. Remember, Chad told David that this is where he had gotten his authority to gather the 144,000. David testifies that he left Lori's home on Monday the 23rd of September. He says he was anxious to see his son. He left confused and trying to discern the weak because he said what they were teaching did not match their character. Jim asks, their character was good, right? And David says, quote, I saw goodness, yes. I didn't see any reason to suspect. The defense has no further questions. So Rachel Smith stands to conduct a brief redirect. She says that the defense counsel asked him about dreams and visions, but she wants to talk to him about reality. She asks, on the evening of September 22nd, 2019, who carried JJ up to bed? And David answers, Alex. So Rachel continues, on the morning of September 23rd, 2019, who told you where JJ was? And David answers, Lori Vallow. After asking if Lori said she sent JJ with Alex and David answering yes, the prosecution has no further questions. David Warwick is released from his subpoena and he is escorted out of the courtroom. Now, I know it's hard to see people defending Lori Vallow, but like I said earlier, they are just doing their jobs. We need defense attorneys, and I will give them props where props are due. They did a good job in cross-examining David Warwick. I didn't really question his testimony until Jim Archibald laid in on him. Some of the things that Jim exposed were pretty alarming and made David a questionable witness for me. Can we trust the testimony of those who were in the inner circle of Lori and Chad? Are they telling us the whole truth? The cross-examination done by defense counsel of David Warwick and another witness later on that I have not talked about yet, named Audrey, really make me question, how trustworthy are the friends of Lori and Chad? So while the defense does not have much to work with here because this is a really awful case to be assigned, I will say they have done a good job at discrediting a couple of witnesses. I will also say that the prosecution has done a phenomenal job as well. Their questioning of Zulema was gold. They made me kind of trust her, even though I've always questioned her. I give props to everyone who has had to work this case. investigators, counsel, the judge, everybody. It's definitely not an easy one. Following David's testimony, a lunch break ensues. When court is back in session, Judge Boyce says that because the state's case had moved forward this week quicker than planned, the prosecution asked that there is no trial held on Friday, April 21st. So Thursday will conclude the end of week three in this trial, from when jury selection began. It will be the end of week two since witness testimony started. Spencer Rammel calls the next witness, Detective Thomas Brewster Mattingly, of the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. He has worked in law enforcement for the last 22 years. Detective Mattingly was working on January 3, 2019, when the Fremont County Sheriff's Office and the FBI executed a search warrant at Chad Daybell's property at 202 North, 1900 East. He testifies that after collecting the evidence, he logs the evidence into the evidence room at the station in St. Anthony. Three officers have access to this evidence lab: Detective Mattingly, Detective Fabnich, and Detective Kaya Kamanu. We heard his testimony earlier this week. On January 15, 2023, the detective takes electronic items collected from the search warrant at Chad Daybell's property on January 3rd down to Salt Lake City, Utah, to the IWR-CFL, which is the Intermountain West Regional Computer Forensic Laboratory. This concludes Detective Thomas Brewster Mattingly's testimony for today. However, the prosecution does not want him released from his subpoena because he will be testifying again during this trial. The defense has no questions. So next, the state calls FBI analyst Benjamin Dean. He works in the Salt Lake City, Utah field office. Benjamin was responsible for following up on tips in this case after a press release was put out about the missing children on March 5, 2019. He also analyzed electronic evidence seized from Chad Daybell's home. Spencer Rammel asks if Benjamin has specific training in analyzing electronic devices, and he testifies yes. He was trained in digital evidence collection and exploitation, as well as the use of telephone analyst software. Benjamin reviewed two different Blu-ray discs containing evidence storage. Benjamin states that a unique FBI specimen number was clearly written on each disc. He reviewed the first disc and found information belonging to Seth Daybell, one of Chad and Tammy's sons. The second disc was clearly the cell phone information of Tammy Daybell. He indicates that he knew this because the device name was under Tammy Daybell. Secondly, the phone number connected was determined to be Tammy's, and he viewed messages and emails that were signed off by Tammy. Tammy's phone also received notifications from Facebook every time there was a post made in the Facebook group Daybells and Murs. Everything on Tammy's phone indicated that she had a close relationship with the Daybell children. No outgoing notifications went out from this device since October 18th of 2019. Spencer Rammel now asks if there were any messages that stood out that were sent to and from Tammy's device on September 9th, 2019. Benjamin Dean found messages that day sent between Tammy Daybell and her husband, Chad Daybell. Through information found on the device, it was clear that Chad Daybell, Tammy Daybell, and their son Garth Daybell all lived together at the Daybell home, where Tammy is killed and where Tylee and JJ's bodies are later found. With that, the prosecution asks to admit State's Exhibit 229. Benjamin reviews this document. The message stream starts on this date at 11:53 a.m. The first message is sent from Chad to Lori, and it reads, "Well, I've had an interesting morning. I felt I should burn all the limb debris at the fire pit before it got too soaked by the storms. While I did, I spotted a big raccoon along the fence. I hurried and got my gun, and he was still walking along. I got close enough that one shot did the trick. Fun times." Chad sends another message 3 minutes later. Gonna shower now, then gonna go write for a while at BYU. Love you. I love Tammy's reply later that afternoon. She says, good for you. The first message Chad sent this day stood out to Benjamin because most of the texts between Chad and Tammy were short and to the point. This one was longer and more detailed than any other ones. They mostly talked about the day-to-day things like groceries. The date of this message also caught Benjamin's attention because the last time Tylee was ever seen alive was on September 8, 2019 in Yellowstone National Park. With that, Spencer Rammel completes his direct examination and the defense has no questions. Benjamin Dean is released as a witness. Next, Rachel Smith calls Sergeant David Stubbs for the prosecution. He works for the Rexburg City Police Department. To aid in Sergeant Stubbs' testimony, the state moves to admit business records from Exhibit 103. These are from businesses like Amazon or Google. Multiple other exhibits are admitted, including business records of Chad Daybell's Spring Creek Book Company from January 1, 2019 through July of 2022. The sergeant testifies that he has been in law enforcement for 30 years and is a supervisor over the detectives. He became involved with this case on November 1, 2019 after being contacted by the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, who was searching for a Jeep Wrangler after they had been contacted by the Gilbert police about their investigation into the attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreaux. He testifies at that time, persons of interest that may have information were Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow, Alex Cox, and Tylee Ryan. The Jeep was located on November 4, 2019. Police had conducted surveillance of the individuals in the days prior when they weren't able to locate the Jeep at Chad Daybell's property. We heard testimony earlier in the trial about this surveillance, where Chad and Lori were seen together at Costa Vida, Hobby Lobby, and Mountain America Credit Union in Idaho Falls. I want to mention here, these three locations sit directly across the street from where I went to high school here in Idaho Falls. While it was a field back then that we camped in, by the time Lori and Chad are seen here, it had turned into a business park. Costa Vida, Mountain America, and Hobby Lobby can all be accessed within the same parking lot area. The sergeant goes on to testify that just after the Jeep was located, the Rexburg police have another encounter with Lori Vallow, Chad Daybell, and Alex Cox when a welfare check on JJ Vallow is requested by Kay Woodcock. Sergeant Stubbs was wearing a body cam when he had this contact with Lori on November 6, 2019. This footage is admitted as evidence and presented to the jury.
She's Christ gave it to the grandmother she came from, and she wanted us to come to my husband and I, who died earlier this year. He passed away. Since he passed away, she's been trying to fight me for him, being really horrible to me. She's a paternal friend.
Okay, thank you.
That makes sense.
That's what I mean. The paternal grandmother.
Yes, he has autism and ADHD. He doesn't really talk to people. Like, he's very special needs. So I have been a special needs school there. She was trying to... So what happened was, my husband, we were married 15 years and have raised all these 5 kids together, switched his life insurance policy to her, right? To his sister, who got $1 million when he died, and we got nothing for being raised JJ, and all the kids got nothing, and everybody got nothing. She got $1 million. So I knew she was going to try to sue me for him, or she now has this $1 million, so she can hire people to help. And I have nothing.
But you have legal custody.
He's my son. I adopted him. Right. He's 2 years. We had him from the time he was 8 months old until 2 years old. She does nothing but wants to cause me trouble. So I don't tell people the truth about where we are and what we're doing because of those reasons. So I look like a suspect, but I am not a good person. Raised all of my kids. I've done everything that I'm supposed to do in life. But that's what is causing me trouble right now. So.
Yeah.
stood out to Detective Stubbs that Lori referred to Chad Daybell as her brother's friend, because at the time of this interaction caught on body cam, the investigators already knew that Lori and Chad had gotten married. Detectives had also already conducted surveillance and witnessed the couple affectionate together. He also notes that he was concerned for officer safety at this time because they had information that an individual in this home may have been involved in the attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreau. On top of that, it was clear Lori was being evasive, and Sergeant Stubbs noticed movement at the top of the stairs inside the home. He already thought it was weird Alex wouldn't come down to talk with officers after being talked with the day before. So this put him on edge. Judge Boyce now calls for a mid-afternoon break before another video will be played for the jury. This next video is more body cam footage when officers return to speak with Lori after they could not get a hold of Melanie Gibb. Once the video is played, Rachel Smith asks what step the department took after this final interaction with Lori. Sergeant Stubbs testifies that they continue to try and get a hold of Melanie Gibb. And that same day, she did contact them and let them know she did not have JJ Vallo. Following that, they checked to see if Tylee was enrolled at BYU Idaho. They found that she was not. Officers also confirmed that JJ had never been drugged into school there in Rexburg. Lori also did not have him enrolled in a special needs school in Arizona at that time. Sergeant Stubbs testifies that due to the facts they discovered, a search warrant was obtained for Lori Vallo's residence. Now the prosecution asks to play Sergeant Stubbs' body cam footage from the day that the search warrant is executed. It's played on screen for the jury and the courtroom.
Okay, this is the search warrant on apartment number 175. Just in the front door, this is the front room. This is the damage to the door on a no knock entry warrant. Here's a door jam, kitchen area, keys. Pioneer Road. down to the south. A single bed, a double bed, a closet containing a couple coats, one empty box, a fan, some empty hangers, what appears to be a bedspread, and this box here that appears to have possibly winter clothes, female winter clothes inside. Continuing to the bedroom, we have, this is the one to the north, we have a bed, appears to be some bedding on the floor. We have three cases here, all containing guitars.
Once the video concludes, court is adjourned by Judge Boyce, and week two of witness testimony comes to an end. Detective David Stubbs will be back on the stand the following week to continue his testimony. This podcast was produced by True Crime Exposed and is hosted by me, Kayla Waters. Please leave us a 5-star written review as we are a new podcast and help spread the word.